Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Women like people, men like things. Women look for work-life balance, men seek status. Women are prone to anxiety, and therefore, Google shouldn't do, quote, arbitrary social engineering of tech just to make it appealing to equal portions of both men and women. Well, that, in a nutshell, is part of an internal memo written by James Damore, a senior engineer at Google. He said that the company goes too far in its attempts to diversify its workforce. He also wrote that Google's company culture has left it blind to its own biases and was alienating conservatives. Because of all possible forms of diversity, Damore says Google most strikingly lacks viewpoint diversity. Well, in response, Google fired Damore, saying he had violated the company's code of conduct. But Damore's defenders are saying that it's Google that's violated his right to express his viewpoint. Well, this is a truly interesting moment because tech does actually lack diversity, and Google prides itself in having an open office culture. But what happens when those two issues clash in the way that they have at Google? Well, joining us now with her perspective is Colleen Ammerman. She's director of Harvard Business School's Gender Initiative, and she's with us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Hi, Meghna.
Hi. Well, first of all, I should say that, again, I should reiterate that James Damore had written what was initially an internal memo for Google, and then over the weekend it got leaked. So it wasn't intended to be for the outside public, but we've all seen it now, and we'll put a link up to it at radioboston.org. What was your first response when you read his memo?
Well, my first response was, frankly, it's not that surprising.
Why?
Well, you know, I think for one thing, I think that these kinds of arguments and ideas have been circulating for a long time, right? So they're not new. I think the other reason it's not surprising is that, you know, these beliefs are pretty prevalent. So I think we are seeing the fact that there's maybe a kind of social stigma to holding these beliefs, but they're out there. People do think them. There's actually Pew has done some research on the extent to which people do believe there are these kinds of innate gender differences, mm-hmm. I don't know the stats offhand, but a lot of people do believe in these kinds of innate gender differences. And in fact, I think what's really key is that the more so that people have those beliefs, the more likely they are to hold traditional beliefs about gender roles and norms,
right,
and sort of what women and men should and shouldn't do.
So there are two parts to what Damore wrote. There's this sort of gender diversity in tech and Google, and at Google specifically, issue. And then there's also the part about viewpoint diversity. And we'll get to that in a second. But I just to stick with the gender part, I mean, what kind of, I'll be honest, really rubbed me the wrong way when I read it is that he was using wishy-washy science and drawing inferences for about women in general from supposed averages, mm-hmm. and therefore saying that it doesn't actually, he was like, we should actually apply cost-benefit analysis to all this, and it doesn't benefit Google to try and increase gender diversity in its workforce if women innately aren't that interested in tech.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right, and so I think that's problematic on a couple of levels. So one is that the science behind the notion of innate characterological, biologically determined sex differences just isn't there. And I think you've seen a number of people kind of come out and say this, both, former Googlers. Adam Grant actually had a nice post on LinkedIn this morning kind of summarizing that research. So I think number one, it's just not true, right? I think the important thing to remember again is that, those beliefs may not be true, but they can seem true, right? So, I think one important thing to realize is that the kinds of bias that we're dealing with today, which are, as I think we all know, often implicit or unconscious, our founding faculty chair at the Gender Initiative, Robin Ely, has termed second-generation bias. These are subtle. They're not always explicit. And so they can look a lot like preferences, right? And so it might seem that what we're dealing with is women and men making different choices, but we're actually dealing with women and men facing very different kinds of contexts and reacting to those contexts.
Right. I mean, one of the things that really got me was when he says that he claims that men are more likely to be status-seeking and therefore seek out leadership positions, and women are less likely to do that. I mean, look, in the cases of certain individuals, that might be true, but it's such a wildly simplistic thing to say for what is one of the biggest gender gaps in tech in terms of leadership and executive level positions.
Right, which is not just true in tech, right?
It's true overall,
generally,
in the business world.
Right? So, I mean, I think, you know, again, it's... You know, the evidence is actually that's out there actually sort of supports the inverse relationship, right? So there's some research from sociologist Paula England, also some research from the 90s by Ruskin and Ruse, suggesting that what actually is more likely to happen is that as women move into professions, they lose status, right? So it's not so much women sort of happening to choose lower status professions or jobs or roles, but that what's associated with women when something becomes feminized, it loses status. You know, I think the other thing that's really important, though, is, you know, that I really want to highlight is that high status jobs in tech, but I think broadly, often come with a pretty high cost in terms of the kinds of hours and demands that are placed on people.
Well,
right?
And this is a point that Damore makes in his memo also. He says that women want more work-life balance, and so therefore they might not seek those jobs.
Exactly. And I think this is a great example of, you know, this is not about preference. This is about the different kinds of conditions that men and women face. So long hour, you know, high demand, high intensity jobs, research is very clear, are pretty unmanageable for everybody, right? And so, you know, again, some of our own faculty, our chair, Robin Ely, also her colleague in the organizational behavior unit, Lakshmi Ramarajan, you know, have done a field study that really shows that those kinds of demands do push people out of an organization, both men and women. What happens is that men and women respond differently to those pressures, right? And it's because of it's because of the gender norms and expectations that circulate in our culture, right? So men can actually be ideal workers, can put in a lot of hours at work, and sort of feel psychologically and socially rewarded as good parents because they are breadwinners, right? So there's a way in which the expectations for men come together in a way that allows them to pursue those kinds of careers with less psychological and social cost. For women, of course, it's diametrically opposed. You know, the mandate to be an ideal worker, to be 100% devoted to your job, comes into direct conflict with the social mandate to be a good parent, be 100% devoted to your family. So women are really facing a kind of impossible choice.
Yeah.
And that's not really a reflection of their ambition or their aptitude or their competence.
Right. So what's really interesting to me about what happened to James Damore is, you know, in a sense, he has once again prompted important conversations about diversity in the workplace and diversity in tech. I mean, he may have done so by putting forth wildly simplistic stereotypes that are easily refuted by other evidence. But nevertheless, the conversation is occurring. Google ended up firing him, saying that he was promulgating biases that were in opposition to the company's core values. But that plays right into what Damore's other point was that he believes there's a sore lack of viewpoint diversity at Google. And I think you may have a point there. I mean, did Google handle this in the right way?
Well, so I don't work at Google. I don't run Google. So I don't want to sort of presume to say
you are at Harvard Business School.
Well,
so
true, but you know, I work in higher ed, so I'm not running the company. But you know, it is actually a tough question, and I think it's worth talking about. I in some ways think there's a little bit of a category confusion when we're in this conversation that we're having about the reaction from Google. You know, so I mean, in terms of the company, you know, if I were running the company or in the company, one thing that would really concern me is if this person is a manager, right? Because, you know, clearly he holds these beliefs and, you know, is willing to publicly circulate them within the company. And whether he realizes it or not, he probably is acting on them, right? So that's a concern in terms of you don't want managers in place who might be systematically disadvantaging people.
Well, and I think part of the issue at Google was they have if I remember correctly, they have a system by which, you know, peers are evaluating each other.
Right, right. Yeah. So it can have a real impact. And I think, of course, you know, as a lot of people have pointed out, you know, just circulating the memo itself has an effect on women in the company. And really is, I think, pretty destructive. You know, that said, though, I actually do think it's important to acknowledge that the memo, it is allowing us to have a conversation that we need to have. And I think, you know, he's right that these issues really aren't discussable. And that is a problem, right? So, you know, again, going back to what I said earlier, these beliefs are held by people. And whether or not people realize them, even if they realize maybe they're not socially acceptable, they are acting on them, even if it's unconscious. And we don't really have a forum to talk about that. And in fact, you know, that means we don't have a forum to say, hey, actually, the research doesn't bear out that there are gender differences. The research doesn't bear out that women aren't as good at negotiating. What the research bears out in the case of negotiation is that when the context is one where parameters are clear and the participants have equal access to information about the terms of the negotiation, we don't see gender differences, yeah. Right? Because we're not relying on stereotypes. So I actually do think it's important for us to be having this conversation and to make this something that is a discussable part of how we work.
So practically speaking then, mm-hmm. in the workplace, how do you do that? How do you have those conversations?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, one of the things that led to this moment is that Google, you know, has all these employee chat boards or rooms mm-hmm. or whatever, or a system by which they say they want to encourage open conversation, and it led to this.
Right. And that is, I mean, that is challenging. You know, it's challenging for companies and for leaders. I mean, I think, you know, just using the example of Harvard Business School, you know, there's been, you know, some coverage in the media of sort of how we as an institution have tackled diversity and inclusion. And I can absolutely say that the fact that our senior leadership and our dean really made it something that was discussable and acknowledged made a big difference. So I think a leadership commitment to that and to saying that it's important is key. Unconscious bias is a great example. You know, that especially in tech right now is kind of, you know, the sort of, you know, hot way, you know, one of the key ways to approach diversity. And there's all kinds of trainings out there.
But I mean, Damore's saying that there's an unconscious bias against conservatives in tech, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
That's basically what he said.
Well, and I think, you know, and I think what I would say about unconscious bias trainings is you can, you know, have as many as you want. They can be really great. People can really understand the science and the concept and maybe even fully buy into it and believe it and get it. But if you're not actually engaging in a conversation about implicit bias in your processes as they're happening, you're not really going to make change, right? Because unconscious bias is unconscious. So even once you go to the training, you're still doing it, right? So there needs to be space when you're thinking about evaluating people or mentoring people to raise those questions and sort of do some self-reflection and interrogation, you know, an interrogation among your colleagues. So really making it safe to discuss and saying it's a priority for us to have an ongoing conversation about it, not a kind of one and done, we've had a training, these are the norms, and the conversation's over,
right.
Sort of approach.
Right. So, you know, is this reverberating? I mean, there's obviously been a lot of in reaction to the memo and mm-hmm. Google's actions from all corners in the past couple of days. But do you think this has the possibility to reverberate for quite some time in tech because of the conversations it's triggered?
I do. I hope so. I mean, you know, I think just even more broadly, it seems like we are having a pretty vibrant conversation, you know, about diversity and inclusion and different kinds of axes of inequality in organizations. I think for a lot of reasons, it seems to be kind of focused on tech right now. You know, we, of course, have had the recent stories about actually quite explicit sexual harassment and
right.
intimidation in Silicon Valley. You know, I think that for whatever reason, that seems to be the locus. But I think, the more that these stories come out, as disheartening as they can be, I think it does open up a space for conversation. And I, you know, certainly hope that it's something that persists.
Well, Colleen Ammerman is director of Harvard Business School's Gender Initiative. Colleen, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
And before we wrap up, we just want to add this note that this hour, President Donald Trump has issued a stark warning to North Korea. Speaking at a meeting he's holding on the opioid crisis in Bedminster, New Jersey, the president said, quote, "North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with the fire and fury like and frankly power the likes of which this world has never seen." Well, stay tuned to WBUR's All Things Considered for more on that and the day's other news. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.